Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app. With your help, we can continue to stand up for free speech, for open debate and rational discussion, reaching new audiences and bringing important information free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Visit realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference.
This is The Fourth Estate on RCR Reality Check Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to The Fourth Estate on Friday, September the 6th, our first show of spring. The sun is shining and the birds are singing about the faint promise of summer that floats on a light southwesterly breeze. It's hard not to feel optimistic gratitude that we're alive in this wonderful country, albeit in what the ancient Chinese euphemistically like to call interesting times. Today we will look at some of the interesting things that characterize these interesting times, the fallout from the assault on Posey Parker, the financial woes of the Fourth Estate, the weaning of anti-disinformation group Toha Toha from the public teat, Britain's apparent descent into the polite British fascism anticipated by George Orwell in his 1937 book The Road to Wigan Pier. We'll discuss the backward-looking tendency of political press releases that make up so much of New Zealand's news, and we'll also examine the extent to which social media can appear to drive negativity. If we have time, we might even wonder what symbiosexuality is. With us this morning, two lone voices we've brought in from the wilderness. Jody Brunning is a regular guest on Reality Check Radio, and she's studied extensively the production of information, what gets researched and what doesn't. She is a consulting sociologist and lead researcher for Physicians and Scientists for Global Responsibility. She blogs at Talking Risk on Substack. Welcome, Jody. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, Marty. Thank you for inviting me on.
Great. And Jill Ovens is the secretary and leader of the Women's Rights Party and a trained journalist herself. Her master's degree was in newspaper credibility from the University of Kansas School of Journalism in the 1980s. Jill mistakenly thought that people might trust their local newspapers more as they would know some of the sources and be closer to the stories, but was a sadder and wiser woman when she learned that this was not the case, well before fake news was a known phenomena. Great to have you here, Jill.
Thank you.
Hope I got that right.
Sure. I was also a senior lecturer in journalism at AUT for many years.
Right. So you're responsible for some of these problems.
No, because I note that most of those people writing these articles now only started in like 2020, and so I was long gone from then. The people who are who I taught were people like Duncan Garner.
Right.
That age group.
Yeah, it was I got taught by people who were given jobs like waiting outside hotels to see if there were people who weren't married checking in.
Oh, gosh, that must have been the truth.
Yeah, no, all sorts of things like that. But, yeah, no, I saw the change while I was a journalist back in the early 2000s. It's quite dizzying. We'll kick off because we've got a fair bit to get through. We've seen in the Eliana Rubashkin, or a.k.a. Goldbestein case, a real contrast between the traditional Fourth Estate and the emerging, I guess you might call it the Fifth Estate, the citizen journalists whose commitment is reporting what happens rather than satisfying the ESG agendas of multinational corporations who advertise. And Simon Anderson, I don't know if you caught his interview with Paul Brennan this week, was very interesting. He took footage, of course, of the mayhem at Posey Parker's ill-fated rally at Albert Park last year, and was struggling with the technology a bit. And during the time he was trying to download footage from the 360-degree camera that he captured what was happening on, the mainstream media represented the attack on the women by trans activists one way, and then Simon released his footage, and it became clear that the legacy media had been somewhat deceptive, to put it mildly. How do you think the media coverage impacted the decision, if at all?
Yeah, so it was, at the time, it was absolutely appalling. They portrayed the event as the protesters were exercising love and peace, and that was certainly not the experience of those of us who were there inside the barriers as they came crashing down. And so it was really great that Simon got that video footage and showed what it was really like. And I still can't watch that video footage with the sound on, because the noise was so loud. It was really traumatizing. And, you know, if you have really, really loud noise over a period of time, that's torture. And it certainly has had an impact on myself and others I've talked to. So they tend to portray that there was an isolated incident of violence when the 21-year-old man from Gisborne punched the 71-year-old elderly woman. But in fact, you can see from Simon's coverage that as Posey Parker or Kelly J. Keene tried to leave the rotunda, and that was about half an hour after she arrived, and they were forcing their way through the crowd. The police were nowhere to be seen until they got right through, and it was just terrible. People, Kelly J. Keene has recounted how she thought that she was going to die if she fell over, and all she was desperate to do was to stay upright. So the media covered it in an unbelievable way. The result was that 16 media complaints were made to the Media Council and the BSA, the Broadcasting Standards Authority, and not one of them was upheld. And one of the reasons why they weren't upheld was because the Media Council argued that you don't have to have balance in a single story, but you can achieve balance over time, and that 9 days of coverage, which was completely biased over those 9 days that the people had complained about, did not ensure, it wasn't long enough. Well, here we are 18 months later, and we've got reportage from, and basically like Radio New Zealand repeats the Herald story. And, you know, it's quite unbelievable. They continue to describe Albert Park as a raucous speaking event. Well, actually, no one got to speak. That's the first point. Women's voices were completely shut down, and that's missing from the reportage. And when you go online and read the Herald story, at the start there is a video from Eli Rubishkin, and it's a Dear Posey video. They don't say when this video was recorded, but it's really, really appalling.
As a journalist, you notice as well, don't you, that there are some angles you think, well, that's so obvious. I can't understand how the police standing down and allowing these women to be attacked by, some pretty unhinged behaving people was not more of a story than they actually said, we're not here to protect you.
Yeah, well, I was standing right beside a television crew, a single reporter and a cameraman. And I was saying, where are the police? Where are the police? They were nowhere to be seen. I was right in front of the rotunda. There was no sign of the police. I later saw the video coverage, and they were standing around Princess Street, standing around a van, and others have told me that there was an odd policeman over by the trees, way behind the crowd. They made no attempt, and they get credit in this article for having rescued Kelly J. Keene from the event. That was not the case. They stayed. It wasn't until she got through to Princess Street that they then whisked her away and out of the country, saying that they couldn't ensure her safety in New Zealand, and so she left that night and she's never returned. And she's really scathing about New Zealand in her YouTube, whatever that she does. And that gives us such a bad reputation.
Well, there were about 100 million people saw Simon Anderson's footage, he was saying, I think, just from memory. Not great press for New Zealand.
No, and so you talk about angles. Couldn't they have actually interviewed some of us?
Well, they could have, but they didn't.
You know, couldn't they? They didn't. They didn't make any attempt to interview any of us, and they still don't. And in fact, I put out a press release the other day. It was a bit cheeky because I reframed the entire story. I reframed it as anti-women protesters and Kelly J. Keene as a women's rights advocate, which is her own self-description, which they never use. And I put it out there. And, of course, no one will pick it up. No one will pick it up. I knew that because I used to put out press releases when I was working for unions, and they would get picked up by, you know, The Breakfast Show. Radio New Zealand was always really good to me. The Breakfast Show was good. And I would be in the newspapers. But ever since I've been with the Women's Rights Party, I've never had, one time Leighton Smith picked up. But the rest of the time, not a single peep from the media. And sometimes these stories are about women's health priorities, nothing.
I always like to zoom out on these things, and one of my observations has been that they can only describe gender dysphoria as natural, normal, and something that's always happened. Because if we start questioning it, we might start talking about xenoestrogens, and we might start talking about our tanking fertility. And Jody, I know this is very much your wheelhouse, isn't it? That dimension to this apparent sudden upsurge in gender dysphoria by young people.
Well, can I just sort of backtrack a little bit to put my sort of perspective here, just to be really clear? So Kelly J. Keene has put herself in a very important place. I haven't personally always agreed with the way she has done it, but I'm also aware that media will not always present, for example, they're more likely to present her the more angry things she says rather than the more lucid sort of things she says. I also have family, very close friends where kids have transed. They have amazing, like really amazing relationships with their mothers. So I want to stress that those people that were there on that day, I really consider, from my knowledge, are a very tiny percentage of the kids and young people out there that have gone through this. That said, my master's thesis was on basically the social construction of ignorance. It was on the way a policy changed since the 2000s, science policy, to actually reshape, redirect, path direct science into pretty much exclusively looking at research that will end up with an innovation, that will end up with a patent. So if you look at women's problems, women's issues, health-based issues, chronic disease epidemic, you will not get, I'm talking about solid research funding, not a short-term project that's, you know, 100K. You will not get the large funding grants if you want to look at the estrogenic implications of the diet in New Zealand, say for young men and testosterone levels. So what we have is we have this world where people are really don't have a language for, you know, the what's happening with our food ways and our water ways, and then they don't have a language when, for example, we look at that rotunda, because in the media's the way the media has portrayed this is that the vulnerable group are the trans group, and so they're not portraying to people that women actually might be a vulnerable group here, and that's easily done because they can look at, you know, Kelly J. Keene being so strong and so emphatic, and then we sort of see the language being shifted. And there's a particular book that my eyes popped out when I was studying my master's thesis, which I finished in during the pandemic, which is Gross and McGooey, The Social Construction of Ignorance, like a whole book on how, you know, information can be permitted or science and research can be permitted, but it really needs to fulfill the agenda of the big ministries and the big bureaucracies. And so what we see, and then Steve Rayner talking about actually ironically climate change, but what he said in 2012 was that knowledge, if revealed, you know, presented a danger to institutions because it could undermine their principles, arrangements and goals. So media might not actually be too investigatory because it can actually, the implications of them being far more curious might contradict the arrangements and goals of larger powers. And so what we can see that is that ignorance can be deliberately produced by the exclusion of information and knowledge. And we can know that this is a necessary social achievement rather than just a simple background failure to acquire, store and retrieve knowledge. So that's really interesting. So there is, you know, just to understand that there is research literature out there helping us understand that ignorance can be actually very, very deliberately produced.
I'd agree with that. I mean, Jill, you and I probably have different ideas or appreciations of Marxism. I tend not to like it very much. And I see in this the upturned fist, you know, where violence is permissible against an oppressive overclass if you're an underclass or a person who doesn't enjoy the privilege of the person you're punching in the face. And there's an arc where there's the neo-Marxist angle to creating silence as well. There was a Danish academic, Ivan Hansen, who talked about how the main narratives of the Fourth Estate were articulated, these traditional narratives are challenged by changing media landscapes. And so he talks about how in the past some groups have been silenced, but how there should be silencing of those privileged groups to make up for that. He quotes Derrida, you know, who's a famous neo-Marxist academic, and talks about how he talks about creating spaces of silence in the public sphere by silencing certain dominant voices and making room for an increased lack of answers and creating an awareness of the insufficiencies of public sphere. So I think there's, you know, you talk about how there's been a change in academia. He wrote that in 2018. You know, you talk about the cutoff being around 2020. I think there were a whole lot of things happened around that 2018 mark. Certainly the CIA got involved in using AI to censor certain things. And there are things like NewsGuard have come to the fore, actually automating this change.
Can I just quickly?
I was just going to come up with a little saying that goes something like, when the oppressed become the oppressor, who is oppressed?
Yeah.
And so you might say that we have, as white feminists, we have some sense of privilege. But when we're getting punched in the face, when we're losing our jobs, when the only people who can speak out are people who have retired because we have nothing to lose, then we're frozen out of our friend circles, out of our previous political party circles, and then who's being oppressed here? So, yeah. And modern Marxists don't seem to be writing very much about the interests of women. I'll just say that.
No. Jody, sorry to...
No, that's great. What I would like, you know, so the 2018 move was a reflection of the development of technology. So we need to look in parallel at the rise of censorship and the rise of the technology to censor, because the technology now can enable it, whereas maybe 7 years ago that wasn't the case.
Yeah.
And then that fits inside the triple helix that I was just with academia, where academia used to be responsible for education and knowledge and research for information for the public purpose, whereas then they added this third helix, which is for economic growth, and that then pretty much subverted the other two, because the other two were sort of open-ended social issues, whereas that, you know, you can do this black and white economic growth numbers thing and subvert all the public purpose stuff. So I believe this is that's kind of what's happening all around us, like you say, that then enables this other stuff to come out that pretty much suits large institutional actors, not women who often have to leave the workforce for many years because they're raising children, or if they don't leave the workforce for many years, they end up coming home and doing the bulk of the housework as well, as being the primary caregiver. That said, I was raised by a male in my early years.
Yeah, and also when one gets to old age, that gap for childcare, that history of earning less than men because of the pay equity gap, means that many older women are living out the rest of their lives in virtual poverty.
Mm. Well, you know, I've said before on this show, I'm in the LGBT spectrum. I'm the E, and the E is probably the most persecuted group that's not widely recognised for our sacrifice. But I'm an economic transsexual, and that my wife earns more than me, so I'm doing my bit for the gender wage gap. Widely stigmatised for it. But it certainly makes me sympathetic to, you know, what women's complaints were. And one of the things I've really noticed is that one of the ways they sold feminism to women was grossly underplaying how much time is required to raise children in the way they deserve. And that comes with a necessary, you know, someone's got to be available if they're sick, or to sit down and uninterruptedly listen to them and give them attention.
So, Jodie, I'd go back to 2012, actually, with the growth of Tumblr and following that TikTok. Mm-hmm. For that age group that you're talking about, the rapid onset gender dysphoria, which is occurring with young women, in particular girls, and in some cases boys as well. And prior to that, only about 3% of the population would be described as transsexual or transvestite. But there's been an absolute explosion of particularly young women, and you'll see them in the university. They would have been a big part of that crowd, some part of that crowd. But there was also a lot of, I would describe as people who came because they were wanting a fight and were in that other group. And I did observe three people who were carrying really odd flags, bright green flags. I thought, what are these flags? I didn't know them. And they had funny masks on with teeth on them. I've later found out that these are Proud Boys. They were in that crowd with the protesters. They were certainly not supporting us. And the other point I just want to quickly make about Let Women Speak, the format is that Kelly J. King doesn't speak for very long. The women get to speak. And I wanted to make a speech because of the media in that week prior to between Melbourne and Hobart and Auckland. I wanted to point out that Nazis are no friends of women, and neo-Nazis are the most misogynist people you could possibly meet. There's no connection between the likes of myself and others who were wanting to speak at that event and neo-Nazis.
I would be very surprised if the Proud Boys, as much as I know about them, and I don't, my knowledge of them mainly from listening to Gavin McInnes, but I wouldn't see them as natural allies with trans activists.
No, I think they were there to cause trouble.
It could have been a false flag, maybe.
I think they were there to cause trouble. I was saying when we first arrived and there was no sign of any police and there was these barriers around, and I was saying to the people around me, I think we're sitting ducks. I think, and I could see, I said, I think there's some provocateurs here. And I noticed Eli Rubishkin because he was wearing a very odd dress and none of the rest of the women, I don't think any of us were even wearing a dress. We would have been in jeans and pants and things. And I said, I think that's a provocateur.
Can I just jump in here? I've got a mate who's in, you know, 60s, professional, you know, earned as much as any bloke. And we talk about, in my teens, I would go bush with my dad, I'd go four-wheel driving, you know, all this sort of fun, kind of quite masculine stuff, you know. And when I went out to discos, I'm dancing in a, you know, Shearer's singlet and feeling really strong and not, I was never a pretty girl growing up, you know. And so we have these, and I'm married now with two kids, and I, you know, never been attracted to women, but I really respect cool, strong, dare I say, sexy women. And I think that that capacity for example, lesbians to grow up and be strong, slightly masculine women and lesbians, that language has also been taken away. And I think that young people growing up now, because of that, you're correct, Tumblr and TikTok, but also particularly those online chat forums, they take that and they subvert it. Yeah. And again, the technological shift around this is, of course, the opening up of the pharmaceutical industry and the capacity to retail those, the deregulation of hormone drugs. And then we've also got, again, the junk food that's changing hormones and all that sort of stuff that is sitting around that, shaping that narrative. And, of course, the education in schools, where you are much more likely to be cool if you're thinking about being another gender than actually if you're a butch lesbian.
That's right. That's why conversion therapy is often called transing the gay. But about hormones too, you know, there's been an increase. Oh, I mean, I'm talking to a scientist, but there was an
increase. A scientist.
And, you know, trying to hold on to pregnancies and prevent miscarriages by using hormone treatment. And some people are thinking that there is a hormone link to these kids who are now, trans.
And then there's the other, so you've got the hormone shift, which, you know, can be documented. Then you've also got sort of epigenetics. So you've got the nutrients, you've got the hormone, you've got the influences that change the way our genes function. So you've got these sort of layers. So let me say I'm a social scientist researcher, which of course can be taken and shaped whatever way a critical like to shape that term. But, you know, you've got those, if we don't look at all those different influences and we have a language, because there is no researcher in New Zealand that could apply to funding to actually study this. And, you know, for example, I know a professor working at the highest level that looked to get research for estrogen disruption from diets for women with a breast cancer risk and was denied because, of course, it's not going to end up with a patent.
Yeah, well, we know from midwifery, because I worked for the Midwives Union for 5 years, the last 5 years, that there is a person called George Parker at the University of Victoria who managed to get $100,000+ research fund to study trans men who have had babies, whereas nobody in midwifery has been able to get anything to study any aspect of midwifery. And there's certainly a lot of aspects of maternity care.
That fits my master's thesis. Absolutely. Precisely.
Well, we better keep we've done a sixth of our topics in half of the time, and it's tough to segue this. But ideally, you'd have a public broadcaster acting in the public interest to, I guess, critique this and show both sides. We've seen last week that TVNZ posted an $85 million loss, and I guess the question is, that's going to make them more beholden to these advertisers. And so if anything, we're probably less likely to get public discussion. Can they come back from this? Jody, this was something that had your name on it. Any thoughts on whether...
Huge thoughts. When I started researching a decade ago, something I had to learn and to understand was money, was the production of money and the social construction of what money is and how we do it and how we use central banks. So I believe that RCR should be spending time interviewing, for example, you know, the authors of the 2019 academic textbook Macroeconomics, Mitchell Ray Watts. They should be interviewing Stephanie Kelton. Right now we see a lot of climate change people looking at macroeconomics and monetary theory as a way to solve climate change. And, of course, that's subverted when you look at the literature on that. So I believe the Television New Zealand Act should be disestablished. There's no upper-level purposes that require TVNZ to serve a public purpose. We should have a new act. We should be understanding, as they did, for example, in the decades after World War II, that information does serve a public purpose. And we all know, of course, that, you know, the CIA in the US particularly had a very strong hand in subverting a lot of information. But information and knowledge will always be socially constructed. It's how we do it, and it's the priorities that do it. And we need a language that enables, and we need, laws that support people talking about controversial, open-ended issues. But right now, because academia has also been sort of retracted, when you look at the media, they've got nowhere to go to outside of the big institutions or people that are, you know, so-called fringe dwellers. So we have this kind of massive erosion of knowledge that this you know, censorship, disinformation complex can rest inside. So, you know, the disinformation group could only arise because they were sequestered inside the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. This is, you know, this is ludicrous. So this Disinformation New Zealand was closely associated with, you know, Jacinda Ardern's and Chris Hipkins' group in the middle of a pandemic. So this, so these sort of inappropriate fandanglings is what is producing, you know, this kind of pervasive non-knowledge and this pervasive inability to talk about controversial stuff that is open-ended. So yet scrap Television New Zealand Act, do a lot of work understanding what a deficit is and how a deficit can be used for the public purpose. Do a lot of work understanding that if we don't actually have a critical media, we can't then go and criticise the institutions that might exploit that capacity to have a deficit. For example, you know, if your surveillance budget's hidden and black boxed and no one knows what your surveillance budget is, hint, that might be a problem. So that's my response, which I'm sure is sort of nothing that anybody would ever expect because we don't talk about that stuff here.
Jill, let's talk about that stuff here. What do you reckon?
I supported, was it Channel 7, which was truly a public service. TVNZ is not a public service because it's beholden to advertising. But I just wanted to make one point about what you were saying about who do you go to in academia for a source. The other day there was a story about the UK are going to do a review of extreme misogyny as part of harmful ideologies. And so Radio New Zealand ran a story, probably again was lifted from the Herald, I didn't check that out, but they did manage to interview somebody who was an academic at Auckland University, but they tried to interview other academics and everybody was too scared to talk about misogyny. Can you believe it that in our universities there's no one prepared to speak out about misogyny? Partly that is, of course, because we don't have women's studies departments anymore. But, you know,
I can't believe it at all. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah. So who do they go to, you know? There was only a single source in that story, and that was this guy from Auckland Uni.
Well, I mean, you can zoom out as I like to do, and you know, I mean, women thought the CIA and the Rockefellers are doing them a big favor sponsoring feminism in the 60s and 70s, but what they turned out to have been sponsoring was division and demoralization of the most likely opponents. And as I said earlier, I'm very sympathetic to ways in which women's lives could be better. And I think, you know, that is part of our common humanity. I think when you make it an academic discipline, sometimes the danger is more division rather than resolution. I guess
Just on the CIA, though, in the news this week, yesterday, RT, Russia Television, has been, they found a couple in Kentucky or somewhere of Russians, probably spies, who were feeding out misinformation. And, of course, we know that the Russians were very influential in the Trump campaign.
Ooh, I think you're on thin ice there, Jill. I think that turned out to be, what's the word for it in academic circles? Bullshit. I don't think that was true.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, no, I think it turned out not to be true. And again, there's this, I mean, the next item on the list is the disinformation group Toha has been disbanded after they've lost their funding. And I mean, you know, there are all these very familiar threads. The CEO of that organization, Mandy Hink, was a librarian who studied at Simmons University in Boston. So right next to Harvard. Who's gone to Harvard to push the disinformation? Well, Jacinda Ardern has. Harvard has established the Misinformation Studies Unit, which they describe as too big to fail because the glob's on board with it. And so it's again, you've got all these three-letter agencies who have gotten onto this and are using AI to censor what we're talking about. And so Toha, if you look at what they did, they were all sort of arts graduates, so they were very interested in climate change. And they offered as a $400 climate disinformation night school. And that basically there was I was looking through some of the what the course does, and it's understand how disinformation campaigns work and how they impact our ability to respond to climate change. Carries on like that. But there's precious little about addressing disagreements with facts. It's all this creepy PR messaging, mind control stuff. And as I said, you know, everyone involved's got a BA in communications. I mean, I've happened to have studied this stuff at university. I've studied climate at university. I've got a degree in science, and I got it in the early 90s when my lecturers were still saying, look, you know, it doesn't really hold that much, that the whole CO2 is a driver of climate change. It's a part of it, but it's not all of it. So it's quite interesting watching this as a big messaging thing.
Can I jump in? I know we've got to move on, but can I quickly jump in? I've watched my children they're now sort of university, young adult age, but I looked at the work in the NCA at high school, and I looked at how they had to produce information and gather information from primary school to high school. And what it was you, a lot of it was you provide something you're interested in and tell us about it. Or here is the biology curriculum. You could see how narrowly shaped it was. For example, I'm interested in nutrition. Biology curriculum throughout New Zealand does not talk about nutrition, even though plants, animals, birds spend most of their time absorbing and gathering.
Neither do med schools, do they?
Yeah. And so when you have kids that go through academia where there's only a small group that are actually actively debating, and they're not bringing into, philosophy or looking at the precursors to what happened in World War II and the role of propaganda. And so the way they are taught is that information is apolitical. So everyone sees it. I'm apolitical and you're apolitical and it's all got to be apolitical. But it's understanding and knowledge is a mashup of 1,000 different things that all come together, and gradually we start understanding what the truth is. We go upstream, which is a really good sort of sociology term. You go upstream to sort of, and you can only, you've got to go upstream as far as you can, basically, and that is always infinite to understand how we got to the problems we got to today.
And you've got to look at some things that might be wrong. You've got to entertain ideas that may be incorrect. And that seems to be what's been snipped off. And this misinformation, protecting us from misinformation, seems to be all about that.
Well, Jill, fear.
Well, in my time when I was teaching journalism at AUT in the 1990s, we did actually look at those issues. One of our texts was, of course, Noam Chomsky's Manufacturing of Consent.
Mm.
So, but I'm sure that's probably changed now, just judging by these, what's coming out of the media. I do think that trust in the media, this is why I made the comment to the producer that that when I did my study, it was before there was any concept of fake news. And that has no doubt led to a destruction of trust in the media. And I know because my own boys who are now in their 40s, they don't go to mainstream media at all for their news. And nor do my grandsons, who are all in their teenage years. They're all looking at YouTube, which, of course, then flicks the bar to the next YouTube clip, which is the same by algorithms as the one they just watched. So a narrowing of the sources of information. But I can't blame them for not wanting to go to mainstream media, because we're not getting presented with a diversity of news and facts. There's a lot of opinion. I got sick of the Herald because it was just full of opinion.
Hmm.
And so actually, you're not going to like this, Marty, but I spend a lot of my time watching Al Jazeera because I never knew what was happening in Africa till I started watching Al Jazeera.
I watched a bit of Al Jazeera.
Yeah, and you get coverage of the Ukraine. It's not only about Israel.
Watched a bit of Russian television when it was on.
Well, we did used to watch Russian television when we had Sky, can't get it now, and we used to watch also a range of American ones like MSNBC, but we don't get any of that, you know.
Mm. Well, there's that essentializing of people with a different view that I find really troubling. And getting back to that course that I mentioned before, one of the lines that I was looking for was, what is the current state of the art on how to report climate stories and how to deal with the denialists? So whenever you've got a title that starts with the, it's problematic, especially when the government's backing it, as the Jews and the Gypsies found out in Nazi Germany. But that essentializing of someone is, well, what are you denying? Denying the climate?
And what I see across many of the issues that we look at with PSTR is the media will not contradict the central government position. And the way they get around that is they will only quote politicians' perspectives. They will only quote the heads of the institutions' perspectives. If I go into the media with something and try to get it published, usually they won't publish it, but I've had several times in the past where they waited for the right of reply from that institution, such as the EPA. There's an older article in New Zealand Herald Bay Plenty of Times that shows that. And so the EPA came in and said, basically, no, this is how it is. But I was not granted a right of reply to the EPA.
No. And the other thing I note in the figures on the fall in Radio New Zealand, looks like I'm picking on them, but on their listenership, is that they're not very popular in Auckland. Now, if you're not very popular in Auckland, you're not going to succeed, are you? They're popular in Wellington. And why is that? It's because they do go to the politicians and the heads of all these ministries. And the rest of us outside, you know, we have our own beltway, don't we? And the rest of us outside, we don't care. We don't want to listen to you know, Christopher Luxon on Wednesday and Chris Hipkins on Tuesday or whatever the thing is. You know, it's actually, well, I say we don't want to listen to it, but I do. Every morning I've got Morning Report on, but I'm one of the 7% who listen to Morning Report. The interesting thing is that Mike Hosking's ratings were up, but the difference between the drop in Radio New Zealand and the increase in 1ZB is a difference of about 50,000 people who are no longer listening to either and have gone to, you know, the platform RCR or don't listen to anything anymore.
Every opportunity to say it, I say whenever I can, I catch breakfast on RCR now, and it's just such a breath of fresh air for me. And it's I don't always agree with everything that's on there, but again, there's that interest in seeing different opinions without necessarily characterising the people who think them as evil. I find that tremendously refreshing.
And the other thing about it is, of course, is that you can pick it up any time of the day or night. That's the beauty of the digitalisation of coverage. You know, I can flick into RCR or the platform and listen to specific interviews. I don't have to sit there and listen to, you know, an endless stream of Wellingtonians. Sorry, Wellingtonians, I do love you.
Stop taking so much money off us, you bludgers.
So I actually feel grief and sad that I don't trust RNZ anymore. And this is from me years as the researcher that was doing the most research into the risk of glyphosate, the risk of bone cancer to people that were sprayers, and trying to get RNZ to cover my content that contradicted the position of the state that it's safe and effective, and then also trying to get attention to New Zealand's freshwater policy and how there's absolutely no pathway to research environmental chemicals should all those the parameters that show you the health of rivers are degraded. There's absolutely no pathway to step into a bunch of screenings to understand whether it's industrial or agrochemical pollution. And so I wanted to believe in RNZ, but they persistently refused to respond to any of my attempts to contact. And when there's no academic freedom because no one else is researching this work, you know, something's broken. And so I just can't listen to RNZ anymore. I'll look at links and look at articles, but I feel dismayed when I think about RNZ.
On the print media, because that's my passion, and it's so sad to see the demise of that too. When I used to be in the union movement, say we were having an action at the hospital in Whangarei, I would go along to the Northern Advocate and I would talk to the journalist about that, and then there would be a story, right? So when I started the Women's Rights Party, I did a whole tour of the whole of New Zealand, and I made up all these media kits with the intention of going and visiting the local newspapers. So I go to Whangarei and I can't find the Northern Advocate, because since COVID it got bought out by NZME, which is the Herald stable. And there is nobody. And you can look on their website and it's really hard to track down how do I contact a reporter in Whangarei. Very difficult to do. So then we go down country to the Daily News in New Plymouth, where I did actually work on that on the subs bench, and I took students there. Well, it's not in the building it was in before. It's in a corporate building on the 7th floor. And on the lift, there is a sign that says no public access. I finally managed to grab a journalist who was on his way out, and I had a local angle because we had with us an Australian who was born in Waitara, and he took photos of us in our van, and he assured us that there wouldn't be any problem with cancellation, but it didn't get in. We then went down to Whanganui. There, they were closed. We went to the only one we found that wasn't part of Stuff or NZME, and I'll come to the southern ones in a minute, was the Wairarapa Age Times, but that's been bought out now. Our stories didn't appear in any of the above, but most of the time I was unable to make contact because there isn't any local newspapers there anymore. The Otago Daily Times has bought up all the ones from Oamaru down, and we did actually get a small article in the ODT, so I'll give them credit for that. And we met somebody in Wanaka whose paper got bought out by the ODT. But the point is there are only actually three in the whole of New Zealand companies. Oh. And so, you know, there's no local contact. I know my thesis for my master's showed that the trust was actually in the bigger newspapers. But I don't know that that would be, you know, there isn't any in New Zealand anymore.
Yeah, well, I mean, on the one hand, I see that as enormously positive in terms of what we're doing at RCR because the contrast's so great and the market's so open, and people who do listen to it can feel the difference in that open quest for truth as opposed to pushing some agenda. It makes me somewhat nervous because I know that the crackdown is likely to be coming. And our next topic that was there was an interview with Sarah Wilkinson, who's a UK citizen journalist who's been reporting a lot on the situation in Gaza, and she was talking about her experience having a house ransacked by balaclavaed police who didn't offer any identification, didn't show her a warrant, and they could do all of this under the anti-terrorism laws. And that was chilling. And I will see if we can get the link to that put on the show notes. I'd really encourage people to go along and watch it. And as you watch it, the thought or the chilling dawning understanding that I had was, my gosh, again, this is just like the standing down of the police at the Posey Parker rally. This should be a huge story, the slipping of the UK into that fascism I mentioned earlier that was anticipated by George Orwell. And just the overreach of Keir Starmer. And again, you know, this lady was pro-Palestinian, and there have been equally draconian crackdowns on anti-immigration native Britons protesting. So it's almost like we've been played, but like men were played off against women. Did you watch the interview?
I know that they were so they even tipped over her mother's ashes. It's just appalling. So this is why I get really nervous when things are termed as terrorism. But I go back with Keir Starmer to when Jeremy Corbyn was the leader, and he, of course, is pro-Palestinian. So it was framed that he was anti-Semitic, along with a whole lot of other people within the Labour Party, all got chucked out, actually. There was a purge. There was an absolute purge of anybody, including the Jews for Labour people, who are actually Jewish, and they were said to be anti-Semitic. It's very disturbing, but we also get very biased media with respect to that issue, and, of course, John Minto's taken it up. But don't know whether I mentioned it before, but the Media Council thinks it's okay to have biased reporting. You don't have to have two viewpoints, as long as over time there's balance. I can't remember a time when there was any balance with respect to that issue. But the thing about this UK review of extreme misogyny, it does make me nervous, because it's very quick that these things could get turned on anybody.
Yeah, the barn door.
Marie myself,
yeah.
As a woman's rights advocate, could very quickly be termed a harmful ideology and have the terrorism police coming through the house. You know, as that the woman who is critical of China found as well.
Yeah, and I guess, Jody, you're... speaking out against some very, very big money in terms of if you're raising questions about glyphosate and forever chemicals and so on. How nervous do you get about that?
I think it's just about holding the line. And I guess my biggest problem is the media won't care. One of the excuses is that my articles are too long. But I'm always talking about where biology hits technology, and that's really complex. And so if an article that is addressing complex issues, so it's very easy for big institutions to say, you know, glyphosate safe, wear your gloves, you're going to be fine. But if I want to write about, okay, so that one point about gloves, it's when you take the gloves off to hold your mobile phone, to drive the car, and to eat, and the literature shows that massive exposures occur then. And so therefore glyphosate should be something that is very strongly regulated, and that probably shouldn't be sprayed in our public places and shouldn't be sprayed on our food. So I can say I want, you know, glyphosate as a pre-crop spray, but I don't want it on crops, or I don't want it. And that won't be taken, that won't be carried. Or if it is carried, like it was in New Zealand Farmer the other day, it was a digital, I went into the digital edition, but I didn't go into the paper edition. But every farmer, you know, I've got fat farmers in my family, north and south, and farmer mates, and all of them say, yeah, well, it's when I light the fire that I read the paper. and every farmer knows that, you know. So that's how hard the barriers, excuse me, to complex stories. And interestingly, my supervisor up at Auckland University, Manuel Valet, his latest book was on urban pesticide spraying on over Auckland. And so his actual, you know, he did a paper as well as the book, and the paper is actually called Fostering Ignorance to Maintain Public Support, New Zealand's 2002 to 2004 urban aerial pesticide spraying operation over Auckland. So he's tracked all of the ways that the media were managed to ensure that the public, you know, wouldn't criticise too much what was happening, and the way that uncomfortable or contradictory knowledge was hidden and not able to be promoted. So this is, you know, this is a big thing that people actually have to get brave, and they have to, you know, they have to actually understand that the sharing of information is the most ancient thing humans have done. Mm. So if we're told not to share information, but we're told at the same time technology is great and innovation is the answer to all our dreams, but then if we're not actually allowed to use that same technology to foster information between people and then turn around and make a judgment, because it's polarization and different knowledges that is the worst thing, not the having the information that might contradict your thoughts. And I've written about that recently with regards to climate change, because I had 20 years of thinking that, of course, people cause climate change. I had to slowly turn around, and it was a really uncomfortable, I didn't talk about it for 2 years because it was such an uncomfortable process, because I already was doing so many things that contradicted the public, kind of the generic corporate
just thinking, am I just an adversarial character? With the glyphosate thing, I mean, I'm always very keen on little facts that are threads that people can pull. And one of the best ones on glyphosate, I think, is that gluten intolerance just took off like a rocket in the mid-90s. And that was about the time that you started getting that post-cropping spray where farmers were spraying off their wheat two weeks before harvest.
There was three shifts then. First, there was the mutagenic wheat that was a different wheat. And so we were changing out from older wheat varieties to newer sort of higher production wheat varieties. But they were also sort of a shorter wheat that were more easily processed, that let more sun in, and so they sprayed more. But as well as that, they were changing their fermentation, so they were shortening their fermentation. And so I think there's a possibility that the gluten proteins might be a different character after a longer ferment. So there's all these things. So it was an uptick then that started in ultra-processed food and our diets moving away from that, and also the pasta dinners. We moved away from meat and three veggies, which doesn't promote IBD, to a lot of pasta. And so these kids have grown up loving pasta, And so that was also the pasta revolution happened then. So our wheat consumption went from just maybe Weet-Bix and sandwiches to also having pasta for dinner.
Yeah, I had an interesting experience where my kids had eczema, and so we cut out gluten. So I stopped eating wheat myself. And without trying, I get those body scans at the gym. And without trying, I lost 2.5 kilos of visceral body fat in a matter of 2 or 3 months. It was astonishing.
Well, the issue with the simple carbs, the white rice, the bread and the pasta and the potatoes that don't have skin on, is when they go into your body treats them like a sugar because they spike gluten. So straight away that's pushed into your fat cells. And Jeffrey Taubes has done amazing work on that. And so that makes such – and so I end up being hungrier after – the nights when I have pasta or noodles. And that makes sense because that food isn't sitting in my tummy as long as being processed more swiftly, moved into my fat cells more swiftly. And so therefore I'm actually, likely to put on weight when I have white rice and pasta and bread for dinner. And it just the new science actually shows that.
All right. Well, we've sort of run ourselves out of time. There were a couple of other things to discuss, but we've meandered sort of nicely around. Did you have any closing thoughts, Jill, before we close off for the week?
Did raise the issue about the items that have been in the Herald lately by somebody called Sophie Louise, who's a libido, certified libido counsellor apparently, and it's just incredible. And so the headline was symbiosexuality. Is this confusing to you? Because we were too. Here's what you need to know, and I won't go into it, but I just thought about the New York Times masthead, all that's fit to print.
Yeah, I read that and I wasn't any the wiser, to be honest. And it's sort of, as I've grown up in a hypersexualized environment, you know, with the baby boomer, do what thou willst, kind of, if it feels good, do it, and gradually come to realize it's kind of empty. I sort of see this as just trying to drag your energy down to that that level. But
the same reporter, and I'm not talking about the actual issue, I'm talking about the reporting of it and being in the Herald. The same reporter wrote a story about an asexual disabled sex worker. Do we really? No wonder we're not reading it. And you know where they're losing, the mainstream media are losing readership and listenership? It's my age group. And it's quite serious for them because the young ones are not even interested in mainstream media.
And if we talk about libido, we probably won't, the media won't be talking about ultra-processed food and the people that are shifting to, say, ketogenic and carnivore diets that are finding their libidos coming back.
Yeah. Well, that's a good place to close it with the weekend upon us, and we get a chance to relax and have a steak and have a cuddle.
Great.
Thanks so much for joining us this week, Jody Brunning and Jill Ovens. Thanks. It's been great talking to you, and have a great weekend.
Okay. Bye. Thank you for the opportunity.
You've been listening to The Fourth Estate right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio. Thank you for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you. So connect with us today.